Chapter 11. Walking Tours. 1. Ben Hanscom makes a withdrawal. Richie Tozier got out of the cab at the three-way intersection of Kansas Street, Center Street, and Main Street, and Ben dismissed it at the top of Up Mile Hill. The driver was Bill's religious fella, but neither Richie nor Ben knew it. David lapsed into a morose silence. Ben could have gotten off with Richie, he supposed, but it seemed better somehow that they all start off alone. He stood on the corner of Kansas Street and Daultry Close, watching the cab pull back into traffic, hands stuffed deeply into his pockets, trying to get the lunch's hideous conclusion out of his mind. He couldn't do it. His thoughts kept returning to that black-gray fly crawling out of the fortune cookie on Bill's plate, its veined wings plastered to its back. He would try to divert his mind from this unhealthy image, think he had succeeded only to discover 5 minutes later that his mind was back at it. I'm trying to justify it somehow, he thought, meaning it not in the moral sense, but rather in the mathematical one. Buildings are built by observing certain natural laws. Natural laws may be expressed by equations. Equations must be justified. Where was the justification in what had happened less than half an hour ago? Let it alone, he told himself, not for the first time. You can't justify it, so let it alone. Very good advice. The problem was that he couldn't take it. He remembered that the day after he had seen the mummy on the iced-up canal, his life had gone on as usual. He had known that whatever it had been had come very close to getting him, but his life had gone on. He had attended school, taken an arithmetic test, visited the library when school was over, and eaten with his usual heartiness. He had simply incorporated the thing he had seen on the canal into his life, and if he had almost been killed by it, well, kids were always almost getting killed. They dashed across streets without looking. They got horsing around in the lake and suddenly realized they had floated far past their depth on their rubber rafts and had to paddle back. They fell off monkey bars on their asses and out of trees on their heads. Now, standing here in the fading drizzle in front of a trustworthy hardware store that had been a pawn shop in 1958, Frati Brothers, Ben recalled, the double windows always full of pistols and rifles and straight razors and guitars hung up by their necks like exotic animals, it occurred to him that kids were better at almost dying, and they were also better at incorporating the inexplicable into their lives. They believed implicitly in the invisible world. Miracles, both bright and dark, were to be taken into consideration, oh yes, most certainly, but they by no means stopped the world. A sudden upheaval of beauty or terror at 10 did not preclude an extra cheese dog or two for lunch at noon. But when you grew up, all that changed. You no longer lay awake in your bed, sure something was crouching in the closet or scratching at the window, but when something did happen, something beyond rational explanation, the circuits overloaded. The axons and dendrites got hot. You started to jitter and jive, you started to shake, rattle, and roll. Your imagination started to hop and bop and do the funky chicken all over your nerves. You couldn't just incorporate what had happened into your life experience, it didn't digest. Your mind kept coming back to it, pawing it lightly like a kitten with a ball of string, until eventually, of course, you either went crazy or got to a place where it was impossible for you to function. And if that happens, Ben thought, it's got me, us, cold. He started to walk up Kansas Street, not conscious of heading any place in particular, and thought suddenly, what did we do with the silver dollar? He still couldn't remember. The silver dollar, Ben. Beverly saved your life with it. Yours, maybe all the others, and especially Bill's. It almost ripped my guts out before Beverly did. What? What did she do? And how was it able to work? She backed it off, and we all helped her. But how? A word came to him suddenly, a word that meant nothing at all, but which tightened his flesh. Should. He looked down at the sidewalk and for a moment saw the shape of a turtle chalked there, and the world seemed to swim before his eyes. He shut them tightly, and when he opened them, he saw it was not a turtle, only a hopscotch grid half erased by the light rain. Should. What did that mean? I don't know, he said aloud, and when he looked around quickly to see if anyone had heard him talking to himself, he saw that he had turned off Kansas Street and onto Costello Avenue. At lunch, he had told the others that the Barrens were the only place in Derry where he had felt happy as a kid. But that wasn't quite true, was it? There had been another place, either accidentally or unconsciously. He'd come to that other place, the Derry Public Library. He stood in front of it for a minute or two, hands still in his pockets. It hadn't changed. He admired its lines as much now as he had as a child. Like so many stone buildings that had been well designed, it succeeded in confounding the closely observing eye with contradictions. Its stone solidity was somehow balanced by the delicacy of its arches and slim columns. It looked both bank-safe squat and yet slim and clean. Well, it was slim as city buildings went, especially those erected around the turn of the century, and the windows, crisscrossed with narrow strips of iron, were graceful and rounded. These contradictions saved it from ugliness, and he was not entirely surprised to feel a wave of love for the place. Nothing much had changed on Costello Avenue. Glancing along it, he could see the Derry Community House, and he found himself wondering if the Costello Avenue market was still there at the point where the avenue, which was semicircular, rejoined Kansas Street. He walked across the library lawn, barely noticing that his dress boots were getting wet, to have a look at that glassed-in passageway between the grown-up's library and the children's library. It was also unchanged, and from here, standing just outside the bowed branches of a weeping willow tree, he could see people passing back and forth. The old delight flooded him, and he really forgot what had happened at the end of the reunion lunch for the first time. He could remember walking around to this very same spot as a kid, only in the winter, plowing his way through snow that was almost hip-deep, and then standing for as long as 15 minutes. He would come at dusk, he remembered, and again it was the contrasts that drew him and held him there with the tips of his fingers going numb and snow melting inside his green gum-rubber boots. It would be drawing down dark out where he was, the world going purple with early winter shadows, the sky the color of ashes in the east and embers in the west. It would be cold where he was, 10 degrees perhaps, and chillier than that if the wind was blowing across from the frozen barrens as it so often did. But there, less than 40 yards from where he stood, people walked back and forth in their shirt sleeves. There, less than 40 yards from where he stood, was a tubeway of bright white light thrown by the overhead fluorescence. Little kids giggled together. High school sweethearts held hands, and if the librarian saw them, she would make them stop. It was somehow magical. Magical in a good way that he had been too young to account for with such mundane things as electric power and oil heat. The magic was that glowing cylinder of light and life connecting those two dark buildings like a lifeline. The magic was in watching people walk through it across the dark snowfield, untouched by either the dark or the cold. It made them lovely and godlike. Eventually he would walk away, as he was doing now, and circle the building to the front door, as he was doing now. But he would always pause and look back once, as he was doing now, before the bulking stone shoulder of the adult library cut off the sightline to that delicate umbilicus. Ruefully amused at the ache of nostalgia around his heart, Ben went up the steps to the door of the adult library, paused for a moment on the narrow veranda just inside the pillars, always so high and cool, no matter how hot the day. Then he pulled open the iron-bound door with the book-drop slot in it and went into the quiet. The force of memory almost dizzied him for a moment as he stepped into the mild light of the hanging glass globes. The force was not physical, not like a shot to the jaw or a slap. It was more akin to that queer feeling of time doubling back on itself that people call, for want of a better term, déjà vu. Ben had had the feeling before, but it had never struck him with such disorienting power. For the moment or two he stood inside the door, he felt literally lost in time, not really sure how old he was. Was he 38 or 11? Here was the same murmuring quiet, broken only by an occasional whisper, the faint thud of a librarian stamping books or overdue notices, the hushed riffle of newspaper or magazine pages being turned. He loved the quality of the light as much now as then. It slanted through the high windows, gray as a pigeon's wing on this rainy afternoon, a light that was somehow somnolent and dozy. He walked across the wide floor with its red and black linoleum pattern, almost completely worn away, Trying, as he had always tried back then, to hush the sound of his footfalls, the adult library rose up to a dome in the middle, and all sounds were magnified. He saw that the circular iron staircases leading to the stacks were still there, one on either side of the horseshoe-shaped main desk, but he also saw that a tiny cagework elevator had been added at some point in the 25 years since he and his mama had moved away. It was something of a relief. It drove a wedge into that suffocating feeling of déjà vu. He felt like an interloper crossing the wide floor, a spy from another country. He kept expecting the librarian at the desk to raise her head, look at him, and then challenge him in clear, ringing tones that would shatter the concentration of every reader here and focus every eye upon him. You! Yes, you! What are you doing here? You have no business here. You're from outside. You're from before. Go back where you came from. Go back right now before I call the police. She did look up, a young girl, pretty, and for one absurd moment it seemed to Ben that the fantasy was really going to come true, and his heart rose into his throat as her pale blue eyes touched his. Then they passed on indifferently, and Ben found he could walk again. If he was a spy, he hadn't been found out. He passed under the coil of one of the narrow and almost suicidally steep wrought-iron staircases on his way to the corridor leading to the children's library, and was amused to realize, only after he had done it, that he had run down another old track of his childhood behavior. He had looked up, hoping, as he had hoped as a kid, to see a girl in a skirt coming down those steps. He could remember, now he could remember, glancing up there for no reason at all one day when he was 8 or 9 and looking right up the chino skirt of a pretty high school girl and seeing her clean pink underwear. As the sudden sunlit glint of Beverly Marsh's ankle bracelet had shot an arrow of something more primitive than simple love or affection through his heart on the last day of school in 1958, so had the sight of the high school girl's panties affected him. He could remember sitting at a table in the children's library and thinking of that unexpected view for perhaps as long as 20 minutes, his cheeks and forehead hot, a book about the history of trains open and unread before him, his penis a hard little branch in his pants, a branch that had sunk its roots all the way up into his belly. He had fantasized the two of them married, living in a small house on the outskirts of town, indulging in pleasures he did not in the least understand. The feelings had passed off almost as suddenly as they had come, but he had never walked under the stairway again without glancing up. He had never seen anything else as interesting or affecting, once a fat lady working her way down with ponderous care, but he had looked away from that sight hastily, feeling ashamed like a violator. But the habit persisted. He had done it again now, as a grown man. He walked slowly down the glassed-in passageway, noticing other changes now. Yellow decals that said, OPEC loves it when you waste energy, so save a watt, had been plastered over the switch plates. The framed pictures on the far wall when he entered this scaled-down world of blondwood tables and small blondwood chairs, this world where the drinking fountain was only 4 feet high, were not of Dwight Eisenhower and Richard Nixon, but of Ronald Reagan and George Bush. Reagan, Ben recalled, had been host of GE Theater in the year that Ben had graduated from the 5th grade, and George Bush would not have seen 30 yet. But that feeling of déjà vu swept him again. He was helpless before it, and this time he felt the numb horror of a man who finally realizes, after half an hour of helpless splashing, that the shore is growing no closer, and he is drowning. It was story hour, and over in the corner a group of roughly a dozen little ones sat solemnly on their tiny chairs in a semicircle, listening.
"Who is that trip? Trapping upon my bridge," the librarian said in the low, growling tones of the troll in the story, and Ben thought, "When she raises her head, I'll see that it's Miss Davies. Yes, it'll be Miss Davies, and she won't look a day older." But when she did raise her head, he saw a much younger woman than Miss Davies had been even then. Some of the children covered their mouths and giggled, but others only watched her, their eyes reflecting the eternal fascination of the fairy story. Would the monster be bested, or would it feed?
"It is I, Billy Goat Gruff, trip-trapping on your bridge," the librarian went on, and Ben, pale, walked past her.
How could it be the same story? The very same story. Am I supposed to believe that's just coincidence? Because I don't. God damn it, I just don't. He bent to the drinking fountain,
bending so far he felt like Richie doing one of his salami, salami, bologna routines. I ought to talk to someone, he thought, panicked. Mike, Bill, someone. Is something really stapling the past and present together here, or am I only imagining it? Because if I'm not, I'm not sure I bargained for this much. He looked at the checkout desk, and his heart seemed to stop in his chest for a moment before beginning to race double time. The poster was simple, stark, and familiar. It said simply, "Remember the curfew, 7 p.m., Derry Police Department." In that instant, it all seemed to come clear to him. It came in a grisly flash of light, and he realized that the vote they had taken was a joke. There was no turning back. Never had been. They were on a track as preordained as the memory track which had caused him to look up when he passed under the stairway leading to the stacks. There was an echo here in Derry, a deadly echo, and all they could hope for was that the echo could be changed enough in their favor to allow them to escape with their lives. Christ, he muttered, and scrubbed a palm up one cheek, hard. Can I help you, sir? A voice at his elbow asked, and he jumped a little. It was a girl of perhaps 17, her dark blonde hair held back from her pretty high schooler's face with barrettes. A library assistant, of course. They'd had them in 1958, too, high school girls and boys who shelved books, showed kids how to use the card catalog, discussed book reports and school papers, helped bewildered scholars with their footnotes and bibliographies. The pay was a pittance, but there were always kids willing to do it. It was agreeable work. On the heels of this, reading the girl's pleasant but questioning look a little more closely, he remembered that he no longer really belonged here. He was a giant in the land of little people, an intruder. In the adults' library, he had felt uneasy about the possibility of being looked at or spoken to, but here it was something of a relief. For one thing, it proved he was still an adult, and the fact that the girl was clearly braless under her thin Western-style shirt was also more relief than turn-on. If proof that this was 1985 and not 1958 was needed, the clearly limned points of her nipples against the cotton of her shirt was it. "No, thank you," he said, and then for no reason at all that he could understand, he heard himself add, "I was looking for my son." "Oh, what's his name? Maybe I've seen him," she smiled. "I know most of the kids." "His name is Ben Hanscom," he said, "but I don't see him here. Tell me what he looks like and I'll give him a message if there is one." "Well," Ben said, uncomfortable now and beginning to wish he had never started this, "he's on the stout side and he looks a little bit like me, but it's no big deal, miss. If you see him, just tell him his dad popped by on his way home." "I will," she said and smiled, but the smile didn't reach her eyes. And Ben suddenly realized that she hadn't come over and spoken to him out of simple politeness and a wish to help. She happened to be a library assistant in the children's library in a town where 9 children had been slain over a span of 8 months. You see a strange man in this scaled-down world where adults rarely come except to drop their kids off or pick them up. You're suspicious, of course. "Thank you," he said, gave her a smile he hoped was reassuring, and then got the hell out. He walked back through the corridor to the adults' library and went to the desk on an impulse he didn't understand. But of course they were supposed to follow their impulses this afternoon, weren't they? Follow their impulses and see where they led. The nameplate on the circulation desk identified the pretty young librarian as Carol Danner. Behind her, Ben could see a door with a frosted glass panel. Lettered on this was Michael Hanlon, head librarian. "May I help you?" Ms. Danner asked. "I think so," Ben said. "That is, I hope so. I'd like to get a library card." "Very good," she said, and took out a form. "Are you a resident of Derry?" "Not presently." "The home address, then?" "Rural Star Route 2, Hemingford Home, Nebraska." He paused for a moment, a little amused by her stare, and then reeled off the zip code, 59341. "Is this a joke, Mr. Hanscom?" "Not at all." "Are you moving to Derry, then?" "I have no plans to, no." "This is a long way to come to borrow books, isn't it? Don't they have libraries in Nebraska?" "It's kind of a sentimental thing," Ben said. He would have thought telling a stranger this would be embarrassing, but he found it wasn't. "I grew up in Derry, you see. This is the first time I've been back since I was a kid. I've been walking around, seeing what's changed and what hasn't, and all at once it occurred to me that I spent about
10 years of my life here between ages 3 and 13, and I don't have a single thing to remember those years by. Not so much as a postcard. I had some silver dollars, but I lost one of them and gave the rest to a friend. I guess what I want is a souvenir of my childhood. It's late, but don't they say better late than never? Carol Danner smiled, and the smile changed her pretty face into one that was beautiful. "I think that's very sweet," she said. "If you'd like to browse for 10 or 15 minutes, I'll have the card made up for you when you come back to the desk." Ben grinned a little. "I guess there'll be a fee," he said, "out of towner and all." "Did you have a card when you were a boy?"
"I sure did," Ben smiled. "Except for my friends, I guess that library card was the most important."
"Ben, would you come up here?"
a voice called suddenly, cutting across the library hush like a scalpel. He turned around, jumping guiltily, the way people do when someone shouts in a library. He saw no one he knew, and realized a moment later that no one had looked up or shown any sign of surprise or annoyance. The old men still read their copies of the Derry News, the Boston Globe, National Geographic, Time, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report. At the tables in the reference room, two high school girls still had their heads together over a stack of papers and a pile of file cards. Several browsers went on looking through the books on the shelves marked Current Fiction's 7-Day Loan. An old man in a ridiculous driving cap, a cold pipe clenched between his teeth, went on leafing through a folio of Luis de Vargas' sketches. He turned back to the young woman who was looking at him, puzzled. "Is anything wrong?"
"No," Ben said, smiling. "I thought I heard something. I guess I'm more jet-lagged than I thought. What were you saying?"
"Well, actually, you were saying, but I was about to add that if you had a card when you were a resident, your name will still be in the files," she said. "We keep everything on microfiche now. Some change from when you were a kid here, I guess."
"Yes," he said, "a lot of things have changed in Derry, but a lot of things also seem to have remained the same.
Anyway, I can just look you up and give you a renewal card, no charge."
"That's great," Ben said, and before he could add thanks, the voice cut through the library's sacramental silence again, louder now, ominously jolly.
"Come on up, Ben. Come on up, you fat little fuck. This is your life, Ben Hanscom."
Ben cleared his throat.
"I appreciate it," he said. "Don't mention it." She cocked her head at him. "Has it gotten warm outside?"
"A little," he said. "Why?"
"You're..."
"Ben Hanscom did it!"
the voice screamed. It was coming from above, coming from the stacks.
"Ben Hanscom killed the children! Get him! Grab him!"
"Perspiring," she finished. "Am I?" he said idiotically. "I'll have this made up right away," she said.
"Thank you."
She headed for the old royal typewriter at the corner of her desk. Ben walked slowly away, his heart a thudding drum in his chest. Yes, he was sweating. He could feel it trickling down from his forehead, his armpits, matting the hair on his chest. He looked up and saw Pennywise the clown standing at the top of the left-hand staircase looking down at him. His face was white with grease paint. His mouth bled lipstick in a killer's grin. There were empty sockets where his eyes should have been. He held a bunch of balloons in one hand and a book in the other.
"Not he," Ben thought. "It. I am standing here in the middle of the Derry Public Library's rotunda on a late spring afternoon in 1985. I am a grown man, and I am face to face with my childhood's greatest nightmare. I am face to face with it."
"Come on up, Ben," Pennywise called down. "I won't hurt you. I've got a book for you. A book and a balloon. Come on up."
Ben opened his mouth to call back. "You're insane if you think I'm going up there," and suddenly realized that if he did that, everyone here would be looking at him. Everyone here would be thinking, "Who is that crazy man?"
"Oh, I know you can't answer," Pennywise called down and giggled. "Almost fooled you there for a minute, though, didn't I? Pardon me, sir. Do you have Prince Albert in a can? You do? Better let the poor guy out. Pardon me, ma'am, is your refrigerator running? It is. Then hadn't you better go catch it?"
The clown on the landing threw its head back and shrieked laughter. It roared and echoed in the dome of the rotunda like a flight of black bats, and Ben was only able to keep from clapping his hands over his ears with a tremendous effort of will.
"Come on up, Ben," Pennywise called down. "We'll talk. Neutral ground, what do you say?"
I'm not coming up there, Ben thought. When I finally come to you, you won't want to see me, I think. We're going to kill you. The clown shrieked laughter again.
Kill me? Kill me?
And suddenly, horribly, the voice was Richie Tozier's voice. Not his voice, precisely, but Richie Tozier doing his pickaninny voice.
Don't kill me, Martha. I be a good nigger. Don't kill this year, black boy, Haystack.
Then that shrieking laughter again. Trembling, white-faced, Ben walked across the echoing center of the adults' library. He felt that soon he would vomit. He stood in front of a shelf of books and took one down at random with a hand that trembled badly. His cold fingers flittered the pages.
This is your one chance, Haystack,
the voice called from behind and above him.
Get out of town. Get out before it gets dark tonight. I'll be after you tonight. You and the others. You're too old to stop me, Ben. You're all too old. Too old to do anything but get yourselves killed. Get out, Ben. Do you want to see this tonight?
He turned slowly, still holding the book in his icy hands. He didn't want to look, but it was as if there were an invisible hand under his chin, tilting his head up and up and up. The clown was gone. Dracula was standing at the top of the left-hand stairway, but it was no movie Dracula. It was not Bela Lugosi or Christopher Lee or Frank Langella or Francis Lederer or Reginalder. An ancient man-thing with a face like a twisted root stood there. Its face was deadly pale, its eyes purplish-red, the color of blood clots. Its mouth dropped open, revealing a mouthful of Gillette blue blades that had been set in the gums at angles. It was like looking into a deadly mirror maze where a single misstep could get you cut in half.
Crunch!
It screamed, and its jaws snapped closed. Blood gouted from its mouth in a red-black flood. Chunks of its severed lips fell to the glowing white silk of its formal shirt and slid down its front, leaving snail trails of blood behind.
What did Stan Uris see before he died?
The vampire on the landing screamed down at him, laughing through the bloody hole of its mouth.
Was it Prince Albert in a can? Was it Davy Crockett, King of the Wild Frontier? What did he see, Ben? Do you want to see it too? What did he see? What did he see?
Then that shrieking laughter again. And Ben knew that he would scream now himself. Yes, there was no way to stop the scream. It was going to come. Blood was pattering down from the landing in a grisly shower. One drop had landed on the arthritis-bunched hand of an old man who was reading the Wall Street Journal. It was running down between his knuckles, unseen and unfelt. Ben hitched in breath, sure the scream would follow. Unthinkable in the quiet of this softly drizzling spring afternoon, as shocking as the slash of a knife or a mouthful of razor blades. Instead, what came out in a shaky, uneven rush, spoken instead of screamed, spoken low like a prayer, were these words. We made slugs out of it, of course. We made the silver dollar into silver slugs. The gentleman in the driving cap, who had been perusing the De Vargas sketches, looked up sharply. Nonsense, he said. Now people did look up. Someone hissed shh at the old man in an annoyed voice. I'm sorry, Ben said in a low, trembling voice. He was faintly aware that his face was now running with sweat and that his shirt was plastered to his body. I was thinking aloud.
Nonsense, the old gentleman repeated in a louder voice. Can't make silver bullets from silver dollars. Common misconception, pulp fiction. Problem is with specific gravity.
Suddenly the woman, Ms. Danner, was there. Mr. Brockhill, you'll have to be quiet, she said kindly enough. People are reading.
Man's sick, Brockhill said abruptly and went back to his book. Give him an aspirin, Carol.
Carol Danner looked at Ben, and her face sharpened with concern. Are you ill, Mr. Hanscom? I know it's terribly impolite to say so, but you look terrible. Ben said, I had Chinese food for lunch. I don't think it's agreed with me. If you want to lie down, there's a cot in Mr. Hanlon's office. You could... No, thanks, but no. What he wanted was not to lie down, but to get the hell out of the Derry Public Library. He looked up at the landing. The clown was gone. The vampire was gone.
But tied to the low wrought iron railing which surrounded the landing was a balloon. Written on its bulging skin were the words, "Have a good day. Tonight you die." "I've got your library card," she said, putting a tentative hand on his arm. "Do you still want it?" "Yes, thanks," Ben said. He drew a deep, shuddery breath. "I'm very sorry about this. I just hope it isn't food poisoning," she said.
"Wouldn't work,"
Mr. Brockhill said without looking up from DeVargas or removing his dead pipe from the corner of his mouth.
"Device of Pulp Fiction. Bullet would tumble."
And speaking again with no foreknowledge that he was going to speak, Ben said, "Slugs, not bullets. We realized almost right away that we couldn't make bullets. I mean, we were just kids. It was my idea to—" "Shh," someone said again. Brockhill gave Ben a slightly startled look, seemed about to speak, then went back to the sketches. At the desk, Carol Danner handed him a small orange card with "Derry Public Library" stamped across the top. Bemused, Ben realized it was the first adult library card he had owned in his whole life. The one he'd had as a kid had been canary yellow. "Are you sure you don't want to lie down, Mr. Hanscom?" "I'm feeling a little better, thanks."
"Sure?"
He managed to smile. "I'm sure."
"You do look a little better," she said, but she said it doubtfully, as if understanding that this was the proper thing to say, but not really believing it.
Then she was holding a book under the microfilm gadget they used these days to record book loans, and Ben felt a touch of almost hysterical amusement. "It's the book I grabbed off the shelf when the clown started to do its pickaninny voice," he thought. "She thought I wanted to borrow it. I've made my first withdrawal from the Derry Public Library in 25 years, and I don't even know what the book is. Furthermore, I don't care. Just let me out of here, okay? That'll be enough." "Thank you," he said, putting the book under his arm.
"You're more than welcome, Mr. Hanscom. Are you sure you wouldn't like an aspirin?"
"Quite sure," he said, and then hesitated. "You wouldn't by any chance know what happened to Mrs. Starrett, would you? Barbara Starrett, she used to be the head of the children's library."
"She died," Carol Danner said, 3 years ago. It was a stroke, I understand. It was a great shame. She was relatively young, 58 or 9, I think. Mr. Hanlon closed the library for the day."
"Oh," Ben said, and felt a hollow place open in his heart. "That's what happened when you got back to your used-to-be, as the song put it. The frosting on the cake was sweet, but the stuff underneath was bitter. People forgot you or died on you, or lost their hair and teeth. In some cases, you found that they had lost their minds. Oh, it was great to be alive. Boy, howdy."
"I'm sorry," she said. "You liked her, didn't you?"
"All the kids liked Mrs. Starrett," Ben said, and was alarmed to realize that tears were now very close.
"Are you—"
"If she asks me if I'm all right one more time, I really am going to cry, I think. Or scream, or something." He glanced at his watch and said, "I really have to run. Thanks for being so nice.
Have a nice day, Mr. Hanscom."
"Sure. Because tonight I die." He tipped a finger her way and started back across the floor. Mr. Brockhill glanced up at him once, sharply and suspiciously. He looked up at the landing which topped the left-hand staircase. The balloon still floated there, tied by its string to lacy wrought iron. But now the printing on its side read, "I killed Barbara Starrett. Pennywise the Clown." He looked away, feeling the pulse in his throat starting to run again. He let himself out and was startled by sunlight. The clouds overhead were coming unraveled, and a warm late May sun was shafting down, making the grass look impossibly green and lush. Ben felt something start to lift from his heart. It seemed to him that he had left some insupportable burden behind in the library. And then he looked down at the book he had inadvertently withdrawn, and his teeth clamped together with sudden, painful force. It was Bulldozer, by Stephen W. Meter, one of the books he had withdrawn from the library on the day he had dived into the Barrens to get away from Henry Bowers and his friends. And, speaking of Henry, the track of his engineer boot was still on the book's cover. Shaking, fumbling at the pages, he turned to the back. The library had gone over to a microfilm checkout system. He had seen that. But there was still a pocket in the back of this book with a card tucked into it. There was a name written on each line of the card, followed by the librarian's return date stamp. Looking at the card, Ben saw this: "Name of borrower,
Return by stamped date. Charles N. Brown, May 14, 58. David Hartwell, June 1, 58. Joseph Brennan, June 17, 58. And, on the last line of the card, his own childish signature, written in heavy pencil strokes, Benjamin Hanscom, July 9, 58. Stamped across this card, stamped across the book's flyleaf, stamped across the thickness of the pages, stamped again and again in smeary red ink that looked like blood, was one word. Cancel. Oh, dear God, Ben murmured. He did not know what else to say. That seemed to cover the entire situation. Oh, dear God. Dear God. He stood in the new sunlight, suddenly wondering what was happening to the others.